Well, it's lovely to have you here tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. I have been doing a lot of thinking. A lot of the material that I'll be sharing with you will somehow find their way, or its way, into a book that I hope to have written by this time next year. We live in momentous times, and I figure that Nietzsche certainly has a lot to offer us in these difficult days. So I've called the series Notorious Nietzsche and Religion in the vain hope that people will understand the word notorious, so that Lecture 1, God Killer, The Christ Denier and The Life Affirmer will make some kind of sense if you take the word notorious into account. So it's going to be part of a series, as you can see. So this is the first lecture. And the purpose of it is to introduce Nietzsche in a fresh way to those readers familiar with his writings, those new to them but wanting to know more, and to scholars curious about a different way of reading him. The other purpose, of course, is to dispel what I perceive as a serious misperception, conception, which perpetuate the myth of the notoriety. And thirdly, the series provides, through his theology of suspicion, exciting ways of approaching religion and life into an AI-dominated 21st and 22nd century. You'll be interested to know that there has been a conference at Cambridge devoted to posthumanism in which Nietzsche featured very prominently. So just in case you're sitting there thinking, what on earth can that possibly have? What kind of relevance would it have? Well, it has a lot of relevance. So welcome. So I just want to warn you about the way that I'm going to present the lecture. It'll be more in terms of the German word kennenlernen, which means to get to know in the sense of knowing you as a person. So I'm going to, as it were, be your guide, and I'm going to introduce you to Nietzsche as a person and as a thinker. But his thinking comes second, the person comes first. So, belt up, ready for the ride, and let's journey together. So I want you to imagine that I'm your peripatetic teacher, and that we're wandering around, and I'm teaching you as we walk around, and you know, pointing out a few things, and of course, introducing you to not Plato, but Nietzsche in this case. So first of all, some introductory remarks. It is important not to underestimate Nietzsche's influence. As Paul Bishop, professor of German at University of Glasgow, notes, Nietzsche is a figure from the mid-19th century whose influence reached well into the 20th century and extends beyond into our own time, to the point where he has in some way, Professor Bishop points out, in some way become so much part of our mental furniture that it would be easy to underestimate the impact of his thought. The German modernist poet Gottfried Benn observes that everything his generation had discussed, had thought out, inside itself, done to death, all that had already been expressed and exhausted in Nietzsche. Now that's quite a claim for a fellow German to make. Another fellow German, Ottfried Hofer, professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of Tübingen, describes Nietzsche's reception in the 20th century as the most fascinating in intellectual history. I won't go into the details of that fascination because I think you might fall off your chair if I did. Under the title Nietzsche, This Time It's Personal, Professor Ken Jeans, a great authority on Nietzsche, draws attention not just to Nietzsche's demanding style, but also to the radical nature of his presuppositions. He says Nietzsche makes philosophy personal, paramount and profound. To do philosophy his way takes both courage and insight. He questions our intuitions. He questions not just the justificatory status of what are taken to be some of our most fundamental representations, but our very access to those representations. In effect, Jeans notes, Nietzsche demands that what we do in the way of philosophy should somehow inform our whole life, and conversely, he demands that our whole lives inform our philosophy. And I have to say I regret not only how poetry is taught in schools sometimes, usually by people who don't like poetry, but philosophy sometimes is also taught in a way that seems to have no connection with the real world. Well, that's not Nietzsche. So, as I said, get ready. Scholar Daniel A. Ahearns describes the experience, and that's what we're aiming to do tonight, is to give you the experience of following Nietzsche. His experience was being unsettled and disconcerted. So I shall be looking very carefully at your body language to see whether you are being unsettled and disconcerted. Because otherwise, we've failed tonight, ladies and gentlemen. So Ahern describes it this way. He says, following the trail often means encountering what seems to be dead ends. So if you feel like you've come to a dead end, you probably have. But there's a purpose behind the dead end. Or lines of argument that just dissolve into fragments. Or that leave nothing but a hint, or at best a guess, along with familiar, fairly well-defined markers. Now, I have to say, just in passing, it took me 5 years to work out what those markers are. And I've discovered in those 5 years of preparing the PhD, that if you don't have those coordinates, if you don't have those markers, Nietzsche will not make sense. So I put that challenge to you. I'm not going to tell you what the markers are tonight, but some of them you will guess. And by the third lecture, you will laugh, as my wonderful friend here has laughed, that you will know how to navigate the follow the Nietzsche kind of thing. This then is the challenge, the provocation, and dare I say, the fun. Yes, fun. Philosophy is fun, ladies and gentlemen, of reading, interpreting, and practicing philosophy with Nietzsche, according to the process the Greeks call peripatetic, talking, thinking as we talk, walking. I shall be delivering this lecture by practicing Nietzsche's pedagogy, not just theorizing about it, tapping into rational and emotional intelligences, and perhaps even experiencing an even more nuanced, elevated intelligence, which we might call spiritual. Don't run away. Or intuitive. Less inclined to run away. So, our first lecture then, notorious Nietzsche, the God Killer. If I were to introduce you for the first time to Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900, the Nietzsche I've come to know, I would take you to Berlin and my earliest childhood memory, lying in a bassinet, staring into a deep yellow sun embossed against an intense blue sky. Curiously, it is the image which will dominate the parable, as ingeniously devised by Nietzsche, of the madman and his lantern at midday announcing the death of God. But given the dismissiveness, the skepticism and disdain with which Nietzsche is often spoken in academe, I might have to take you further out than just our solar system. That's why we've been listening, obviously, to Interstellar and Hans Zimmer's wonderful soundtrack for Chris Nolan's film, to which you were listening. A soundtrack which, in my view, matches the title of Nietzsche's first and indeed foundational work, whose details he refined and significantly, in one notable aspect, recanted. The pessimism which leads to nihilism that he learned from Schopenhauer, that he recanted, and spent the rest of his life trying to prove that pessimism and nihilism is a dead end. He could see it happening around him in Europe, and I think we can almost see it happening around us today, can we not? The title for that foundational work was Nietzsche's First Love, from whose central ideas he never deviated. In the German it reads, Die Geburt der Tragödie aus dem Geiste der Musik. The birth of tragedy arising from the spirit of music. What it is usually translated, the spirit of music, I choose tonight to employ another of Nietzsche's terms as well, das Phantom von Ego. I don't need to translate that for you, surely. The phantom of the ego, which Nietzsche deploys to define the fate of the human spirit when it becomes less than its true self through neglect. A person's head full of other people's ideas, whose other ideas have been from other people, and they don't know themselves, and they don't know what they really think. Isn't that today? Fake news? But also paradoxically, Das Phantom speaks to Nietzsche of an indefinable, ethereal mystery, a special quality woven into the fabric of the human experience, known and unknown, and mostly unknown. Hans Zimmer's sounds to which you listened as you entered this lecture hall, I thought I'd give it that august term, speak of what Nietzsche might have meant by aus dem Geiste der Musik, arising from the spirit of music. The bewilderment. I hope you felt a bit of bewilderment. You need to sit with that soundtrack and you will feel bewildered. We as humans feel when we come face to face with the conundrum of space-time and the reality of space-time's inhospitability, underscored by the brutality of the vastness and impenetrability of a cosmos, which defies understanding. The 95% unknown, which astrophysicists name dark matter, even they have a sense of humor, its indescribable beauty and its terror. In sum, Zimmer's music gathers together the admission of unknowing and bewilderment, which Nietzsche insists in extracting from us as a necessary process of naturalization, one which strips humanity of all its illusions and self-delusion. I only had to face the ignominy and the human, the angst of having to try to change my name back to Nikolai on my passport. I gave up because it was such a frightening experience, this business of naturalization. For Nietzsche, of course, the word naturalization is not going from one country to another, but from one country of understanding into another country of understanding. It calls for us to be aware of the actual universe in which we're living. Not this safe little solar system. You know, climate change is nothing compared to what's happening out there, ladies and gentlemen. I've already mentioned our artistic's camp of, a black hole snacking on a sun hundreds of times larger than our own. Of another black hole caught by accident by our powerful telescopes spewing out 200,000 suns. So while we may think of black holes as being very bad, they're actually creating new life as well. So for Nietzsche, this naturalization is that. If you don't live in the real world, in the real universe, then, and if you don't embrace that life, amor fati, in Latin, the love of your destiny, the love of your destiny, the love of your present circumstances, my circumstances. If we cannot do that, and our faith and that amor fati, if they are real, they must together stand the test Nietzsche defines as the eternal return of the same, or the eternal recurrence of the same. The always, the relentless, ever-repeating challenges of suffering, misunderstanding, and profound ignorance which assail humanity, leaving their trail of utter bewilderment, which Greek philosophy calls aporia, bewilderment. If you don't get out of a philosophy class feeling bewildered, we have failed you, as teachers, as Andrew would undoubtedly know. And Greek dramatists and musicologists name tragedy the inescapable shock which an examined life must embrace and transcend. Where do we find Friedrich Nietzsche? How do we get to know him? That's where we will find Friedrich Nietzsche, right where I've been telling you he is. As he leads, I follow. As I follow, we follow together and discover a place such as Nietzsche describes in his masterwork, So Spoke Zarathustra. And in it, some words which I think are really beautiful. It is strange, then, that in the face of inevitable mutual defeat, the irreparable and ultimate defeat of understanding, which life will never allow to tame, and for which life will always remain insurmountable, alien, and the inevitable defeat of action, which will never succeed in ordering the world, which would pacify the longing for order, for structure, for stability, inscribed in every action, is it strange that tasting the bitterness of the defeat on their lips, life and Zarathustra should look at each other and gaze on the green meadow over which the cool evening is running just then and weep together? Is it strange then that exactly then life was dearer to me than all my wisdom ever was? So it is inevitably as we follow that we arrive at a place in the mind of Nietzsche who must address the big questions of life as Professor Moore interprets them and as Nietzsche may himself have posed them. How do we react to pain and loss? Do we turn to ways of thinking that justify and explain our distress to those which console and give comfort? But what if our suffering continues? What if it deepens? What if the familiar way of thinking fails to heal us? What if they come to feel not only ineffective, but injurious? What if untold human energy and hope is invested in exactly the wrong ways to react and think about human affliction? What if these ways are called the flowers of the human spirit? What if they are philosophy, religion, and science? What then? When, on a Christmas Eve, 1914 to be precise, on the Western Front, 14 years after Nietzsche's death, we find ourselves and with him in our imagination in a no man's land, where peace must reign only for a very short time, when soldiers from both sides of the divide must see and do see through the stupidity and madness of war. When they are able to share Christmas together from opposite sides in food and drink, play together, bury their dead, grace those lost lives with dignity and honour, only to continue what has now come to be called the Great War, which Nietzsche, by the way, foresaw. When at the behest of their commanders and political leaders, millions of lives are lost, a war which had been billed as nothing more than a game of rugga, surely to be over by Christmas 1914, was not to be. The carnage continued for another 4 years. Why must we follow this notorious Nietzsche and stop there? Because it is there, ironically, ladies and gentlemen, that 2 years later in 1916, when 150,000 of an especially durable wartime copy of So Spoke Zarathustra, ironically, is distributed to literate troops who are encouraged to take it with them into the trenches, along with, wait for it, Goethe's Faust and the New Testament. Sort of a ménage à trois, with a little bit of awkwardness. I say ironically because Rector P. Hocher, lovely name, isn't it, writing in March 1916, claims that it's beautiful words, I'm allowed to do this because I'm a German myself, it's beautiful words more than for any other folk possess fighting natures in Zarathustra's sense. Yes, the words were beautiful, but as Robert Pippin, a much respected Nietzsche scholar, observes, it is hard to imagine a book less suitable for such a purpose, fighting natures, indeed a book which has at its main theme the sort of self-overcoming that affirms life, not death. So with introductions over, Nietzsche stops and suddenly turns towards us to speak the parable of the madman. Is this what you want? Is this what you think? Is this what you mean? And just about to recite the parable when more words in his spirit interject. In the horizon of the infinite, we have forsaken the land and gone to the sea. We have destroyed the bridge behind us. More so, we have demolished the land behind us. Now, little ship, watch out. Beside you is an ocean. Yes, it's true. It doesn't always roar, and at times it lies there like silk and gold and dreams of goodness. But there will be hours when you come to realize that it is infinite and that there is nothing more bewildering than infinity. Oh, poor bird that has felt free and now strikes again against the walls of the cage. What devastation when homesickness for the land overcomes you as if there had been more freedom there, and now there is no more such thing as even the notion of land. There is so much ocean. Nietzsche now speaks the parable. The madman. Haven't you heard of that madman who in the bright morning lit a lantern and ran around the marketplace crying incessantly, "I'm looking for God! I'm looking for God!" Since many of those who did not believe in God were standing around together just then, he caused great laughter. Or has he been lost then? Asked one. Did he lose his way like a little child? Asked another. Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone to sea? Has he emigrated? Thus they shouted and laughed, the one interrupting the other. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Where is God?" he cried. "I'll tell you. We've killed him. You and I, we're all murderers. But how did we do this?" the madman asked. "How were we able to drink up the ocean? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchanged the earth from its sun? Where is it moving to? Where are we moving to? Away from all suns? Are we not continually falling? And backwards, sideways, forwards, in all directions. Is there still an up and down? Aren't we straying as if through an infinite nothing? Isn't empty space breathing at us? Hasn't it got colder? Isn't the darkness, night and more nightfall, coming again and again? Don't lanterns have to be lit in the morning? Haven't you heard the sounds of the gravediggers who are burying God? Haven't you yet smelled the divine decomposition? God's to decompose. God is dead. Thank you. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How can we console ourselves of all the murderers? We must see the worst. The holiest and mightiest thing the world has ever possessed has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this from us? With what water is it possible to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what holy games will we have to invent for ourselves? Is not the immensity of it all too great for us? Do we not ourselves have to become gods? There was never a greater deed, and whoever is born after us will, on account of this deed, belong to a higher history up to now. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners. They too were silent and looked at him disconcertedly. Finally, he threw the lantern on the ground so that it broke in pieces and was extinguished. "I come too early," he said. "My time is not yet. This catastrophic event is still on its way, wandering in the wilderness. It has not yet reached the ears of this humanity. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars need time. Actions, deeds need time, even after they've been accomplished, in order to be seen and heard, for their true meaning to be understood. This deed is still more remote to them than the remotest stars, and yet they have done it themselves." Nietzsche leans on his walking staff, concludes the parable. The story is still told, how on that same day the madman forced his way into several churches and started to sing Requiem Aeternum Deo, grant God eternal rest, which is an ironic reversal of O God, give them rest, saying I think God might need a rest. When the madman was escorted out, as madmen usually are, or mad people, he was said to have always replied, "What then are these churches now, if not tombs and sepulchres of God?" So spoke Nietzsche through the mouth of a madman. The words appear in Nietzsche's The Gay Science. Lovely title, isn't it? Oh, how that wonderful word has undergone so many changes. After a profound change of his thinking following a health visit to Sorrento in Italy, huge time in his life when he was going to leave his position. He was one of the youngest professors ever appointed. He's going to leave that because he couldn't believe in academia anymore. He just couldn't feel that they were compatible. This period of deep contemplation in Sorrento produces his magnum opus, So Spoke Zarathustra, and the final review of his life's work, Ecce Homo, the Latin Vulgate version of Behold the Man, of the Christ and Pilate scene before Christ's crucifixion. What are we to make of the parable? Can I say to you that I was newly converted to Christianity from atheism, and I remember about 2 years afterwards I had a special, very intense, very earnest convert that people would run away from probably if they saw you coming. But I think I was sort of a bit of a novelty to most people. And this was a parable that I actually read with my little prayer group at the time. And I thought, I only thought of it the other day, how incongruous it seemed that I found this very significant. I would love to bring to the podium my 22-year-old self and interview myself and say, what on earth were you thinking when you read that? Well, maybe it was that sun that I saw when I was in the bassinet. By the way, my daughters have a huge laugh about that. How can you possibly remember something like that? Well, I can. So what are we to make of the parable? Is Nietzsche really the God-killer that his detractors make him out to be? That René Girard, I have spent 5 years trying to prove that René got it wrong because he's a late convert to Catholicism, and of course just assumed that no one could talk like this, even if he is a pastor's son, he wasn't just suffering from PK disease, But there was something to this. And yeah, so I've spent many, many hours thinking about that. Now, I've learned from Nietzsche. He has taught me to observe and listen critically, not in a negative sense, but in the positive sense of ensuring that I adopt the kind of thinking which is open to the realities before me and not take anything at face value, even Nietzsche's plain speaking. He gets very upset, as no doubt the teachers among us would realize, when students just take at face value what we say, we feel that we have failed them, really, because we're supposed to be teaching them to think for themselves. So Nietzsche insists we must make up our own mind as we unpick the parable together. Firstly, we confront the larger context. The book in which the parable is spoken is called The Gay Science. Then we discover Nietzsche's sense of a deep darkness descending upon Europe, the very darkness which informs the parable, and we might say continues to darken in our day. The belief in the Christian God, he writes, has become unbelievable, is already starting to cast its first shadow over Europe. Some kind of a sun seems to have set. Some old deep trust has turned into doubt, the world becoming autumnal, more mistrustful, stranger, older. But curiously, with that estrangement, paradoxically, a hope and a great expectation is born in Nietzsche's heart as he looks across at Vesuvius in the distance and this island that was created by the sheer force of eruption. Indeed, at hearing the news that the old god is dead, we philosophers and free spirits feel illuminated by a new dawn. Our heart overflows with gratitude and amazement. Finally, the horizon seems clear, even if not bright. Finally, our ships may set out again, set out to face any danger. The sea, our sea, lies open again. Maybe there has never been such an open sea. And with that new birth, an audacity, a newfound boldness, questions allowed to arise which refuse to be risk-averse. Is that what you want? Is that what you really want? Is that what you think? Is that what you should be thinking? Questions which disturb because they come from a mind which we would normally dismiss as madness. But in the present times, as with Nietzsche's, such madness materializes, morphs, and becomes a terrifying reality, as we have seen. The madman jumped into their midst and, piercing them with his eyes, "Where is God?" he cried. "I'll tell you, we've killed him. You and I, we are all his murderers." So much ink has been spilled on this, so many academic papers written, so much deep emotion expressed about that statement. You talk to anyone in the street, "Oh yeah, he's the God is dead man, isn't he? Yeah, he's the one that, you know," mostly they say God is dead. Even Nietzsche's best friends with him in Sorrento, Italy, while he was recovering, were deeply troubled by the ideas he expressed. They recognized his pain, but could neither understand nor embrace its cause. If he were able at the time, he might have said what he wrote later in a letter to a friend. "I see and feel my friend's distress, which mirror my own. My time to recall and reflect on myself was terrifying in a way. I saw myself utterly emaciated, utterly starved. My science hitherto had excluded my realities, my true aspirations. I realized that soon I shall have to express ideas which people regard as disgraceful. Even my friends and relations will become shy and frightened." And he finishes with, "Yet I must pass through that fire." In effect, Nietzsche's Gay Science draws from that Sorrento experience. In Tinctured, is also tinctured by that same ambivalence. "On this perfect day," he writes, "when everything is ripening and not only the grape turns brown, the eye of the sun just fell upon my life, I looked forward, I looked backward, and never saw so many good things at once. I do not want to wage war against what is ugly. I do not want to accuse those who accuse. Looking away shall be my only negation. Someday I wish to be only a yes-sayer." Just beautiful. Nietzsche, I just want to reassure you, I want to be a yes-sayer too. I hope so. Aphorism 586, human all to human, is also a reflection with its roots deeply embedded in the Sorrento experience, with visions of mountains, the moon, the sea, of love and spring, underlining how easily those moments can pass us by. And he beautifully writes about how important it is to be aware of our inner lives, what is in our head. Life consists of rare individual moments, he writes, of the highest significance. They all speak truly to our heart only once, if they ever do truly find speech. For many people never experience these moments at all, but are themselves only intervals and pauses in the symphony of real life. Isn't that a tragic thing? I hope to God all of us in this hall today can say that we don't live that way. We are not just intervals and pauses in the symphony of real life. We are part of the symphony. Nietzsche speaks continually from a place of deep gratitude, and here in this short excerpt, with great empathy, I'm quietly waiting for the waves in which my poor friends are floundering to die down. If I push them into these waves, life is not in danger. I know that from experience. And if here and there friendship might be in danger, then we will serve the truth and say, as yet, we have loved only a cloud of one another. Isn't that a beautiful expression? He doesn't castigate his friends for not understanding him. He understands them very well because he's had to pass through the same fire that they are passing through. As we return to the parable, we treat it as one would a symposium, a dialogue with its anticipated Q&A, reminiscent of God's conversation with Job, one of the oldest texts of the Hebrew Bible. And let me tell you, Nietzsche is a Bible man. He knows his Bible backwards. He really does. And I realized after a while that he borrowed very heavily from Ecclesiastes, and he certainly, in this section, draws very heavily from the book of Job. How did we do this? The madman asks. How were we able to drink up the ocean? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? Did we realize the significance of what we were doing? The impossibility of it? Can you, by cleverness, drink the ocean dry? Can you really expunge a horizon as it recedes into infinity? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Where is it moving to? Where are we moving to? Away from all suns? Is not what you have done the decoupling of the earth from its sun? And if so, does that mean we are continually falling backwards, sideways, forwards, in all directions? Is there still an up and down? Are we straying as if through an infinite nothing? Is it empty space breathing at us? Where is our compass now? How will we know what is up, what is down? How will we stop ourselves from falling? How will we ever be certain about anything? So compelling, ladies and gentlemen, is Nietzsche's parable, that we easily slip into a reductionist and literalist mindset, never thinking for one moment that the parable is entirely, in its entirety, turning Nietzsche's irony on all of us. How could we be so foolish as to think we could murder God? If there is a God, and if we even embrace the notion of God, how could we kill him? How could he die? It's a non sequitur. If God is truly God, then ipso facto, such a God cannot die and certainly cannot be murdered. Other gods, yes, who are mere idols, abstractions, playthings for our indulgence. Yes, they die, and when they encourage violence, they deserve to die. But the true God, Moses, whom Moses spoke to, who cannot be defined and boxed in the I am God. He says to Pharaoh, tell Pharaoh that fox he could have said. Tell him the God that's sending you is the I am. The God who will be who and where and how that God will be. So look out, Pharaoh. And I think I pointed out, which made people laugh when I did the René Girard series, that the only act that the magicians couldn't emulate, they could do the snake, they could do the blood, but they couldn't do the gnats, ladies and gentlemen. They couldn't do the gnats, G-N-A-T-S. And suddenly, their magician-like, you know, silliness was exposed. So, anyone who thinks they can box in God is fooling himself, herself, themselves. All of which opens a space to Ecce Homo, the Latin Vulgate, version of Jesus of Nazareth's encounter with Pilate and the crucifixion sentence. Nietzsche's review of his life's work and the subject of the second lecture, Nietzsche, the Christ Denier. While my conviction is based on more than just this following statement, from human all to human, with which I finish, you'll be relieved to know, I found it apt to whet your appetite and mine. It is a Nietzsche statement which tellingly and significantly expresses his surprising and close identification with Christ. I will read you the German, so you know I'm being fair dinkum. I learned that word very quickly in boarding school when I was 8. Dieser Homo bin ich nämlich selbst, eingerechnet das Ecke, der Versuch, mich ein wenig Licht und Schrecken zu verbreiten, scheint mir fast zu gut gelungen. When you read it, and I paraphrase it, and I'm pretty sure I'm very close to the German, this is what he's actually saying. Ecce Homo is who I am. I'm the man. My title aims to make that point. I am identified with Christ on Pilate's judgment day. And when you behold me in the persona of the Christ, I am asking you to cast a long, lingering look, not a passing glance, but make of it a considered, rational, intelligent observation born of curiosity as to why I am so identified. The whole exercise of this book, intended to enlighten and to startle, I suspect, is going to be too successful. I love the humour of that. We're going to just play music for 2 minutes, just to give you time to gather your thoughts. Then we will spend the rest of the time in Q&A. So we listen to the music and just sit there and allow it all to waft over, and then allow the question to choose you, and we will then engage in the Q&A, if that's okay with you. Thank you. It's amazing how long 2 minutes can be, isn't it? So the rules of the situation is very simple. Questions without notice, of course. If I feel that I'm going to trivialise your question by giving a stupid answer or a superficial answer, I will say, question without notice, I will come back to you on that. All right? The second thing is that if you would like to, please go to the microphone, say who you are and pose your question. And of course, at this point, I think we can put on our cameras, everyone out there in cyberspace, and feel free to pose your own questions as well, wherever you are around the world, including Great Britain. What time is it in Great Britain? It must be some ungodly hour, I would think. But then the English are a bit madmen, aren't they? Madmen in the English sun, you know, in the midday sun. All right, so it's over to you, and I don't mind us looking at each other in a kind of a Zen fashion for a time. As those of us who teach in the classroom know, it often takes a little bit of time for questions to rise, you know. Okay, so it's over to you. And if you wouldn't mind going to the microphone, that would be fantastic. Thank you. So that people at home or wherever they are around the world can hear you. You have to go to the microphone. I know you're a very...
If someone wishes to engage with the ideas you were speaking about tonight but has never read any Nietzsche before, what text do you think they should begin?
Well, there are some very good primary texts. My supervisor wrote a very good book for undergraduates on Nietzsche, and I could recommend that. It's a question without notice. I don't have it in front of me. But her name is Professor... Oh, my goodness. Lucy Huskinson. So, isn't it amazing? It's so closely collaborated. Lucy Huskinson is her name, H-U-S-K-I-N-S-O-N. And she wrote this for undergraduates, and I found it very useful, even though I did challenge quite a few ideas, which she then had to read. You know, no doubt she's reissued the book. But I'd certainly go for that. And then proceed from there. You know. But the text, I would probably wait to read So Spoke Zarathustra, because it is his masterwork. But look, another book that I would greatly recommend is the German writer, it's just gone out of my head again, and this is what happens when you get a bit older, The Portable Nietzsche. Just remember that title, and you'll give it to me. No, anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. The Portable Nietzsche. Put that in, you'll get the man straight away, and it's almost there as I'm speaking. The beauty of the book is it gives you lots of snippets from all of his writings, and Kaufmann is the man that I'm thinking of. Was the first American academic to somehow restore some credibility to Nietzsche among American readers. Walter Kaufmann. K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N, and The Portable Nietzsche, which means what it says. You can take it on a train, cover, you know, obviously put your hand discreetly over the cover so you're not seen to be, you know, showing off Portable Nietzsche. Okay, is that okay? That's what I would recommend. So if you look up Huskinson, you'll get a book. She'll have a series of books there. Thank you, Andrew, for that question.
We have an online question from
Francis McCauley.
Yes.
Nikolai?
I'm listening.
Good. Thank you very much for that. It was most engaging. I detect the influence of Meister Eckhart in a lot of what you were saying in your reinterpreting, or that might be the right word. But the phrase that God is dead and so on, a lot of Meister Eckhart's letting go of the God we think we know. Wouldn't Nietzsche himself have been influenced by Meister Eckhart, do you think?
Undoubtedly. But more than just Master Eckhart, I think he was influenced by quite a number of different writers, notably Shakespeare as well. But I think I did try to put forward the point that Nietzsche himself is a mystic of an extraordinary order. He was always on about, you know, setting up a community in Italy, actually, where he felt he could think freely rather than the, you know, sort of cold ambience of the Nordic countries. He felt that Italy gave him the excuse to be more expansive in his thinking, and he wanted to set up a community of friends and the free spirits, you know, as he called it. And also I found, since I've been reading an Oxford person whose name again escapes me, but he's an Indian from India, not an Indian as in Sioux Indian, and he writes a lot about the Upanishads and Buddhism and so on. And I'm absolutely convinced that Nietzsche drew a lot of his ideas of the self from the Upanishads and you know, Hinduism and Buddhism. Definitely. And that's why I think in India he seems to have more of an acceptance among them than he does perhaps in the West. But and I know he's not got a great press, you know, I mean, just recently both in ANU and also at Sydney University they were kind of making fun of Nietzsche in a way. And people. The thing with Nietzsche is, you know, you can create all kinds of Nietzsche in your own image. And The irony of it is that those on the left, you know, claim him as their champion, and then those on the right claim him as their champion, depending upon the emphasis on the syllable that they find in his writing. But as I said, if you don't know the coordinates, and it's not for me to say what those coordinates are tonight, because that would be too involving, but once you find those coordinates, it all truly makes sense. And it's not just that I've invented them, but it's a bit like... Ahern has said, if you follow the trail, there are markers. There are dead ends, and the dead ends are deliberate because he wants you to think, oh my God, what was I thinking? You know, I didn't really want that, or didn't really think that. Didn't think that was a wise way to go. You know, so, yes, I think you're right. Thank you. Francis. Is anyone else from the hall? Thank you.
Nikolai, is he mainly, when he's talking about God is dead, referring to atheistic materialism as the thing that kills God? And on the other side, is he mainly referring to the Judeo-Christian God? Or are there more forces on this side than atheistic materialism? And there are more like ideas of God on this side rather than just the Judeo-Christian?
Yeah, well, if you followed the parable carefully, which you all did, you'll notice that he's having a jibe at those that don't believe as much as those that do believe. Now, I suppose my challenge to, and by the way, I always begin a baptism by saying that, you know, that some of my best friends are atheists and that they're people of integrity, and I mean that. I don't just say that. I mean that. They're not people that are going to believe in something they can't believe in. And therefore they're people of integrity. They're saying, I cannot believe in this, I won't believe in this. And that's the kind of atheist I was until, you know, God, with the great sense of humour that she and he has, caught me, you know, etc. and so on. But, so what kind of God are we talking? So the God that is dead is the God that shouldn't be alive in the first place, you know. Like, if God defines God as I shall be who and where and how I shall be, you know, then the moment we start to define God as he or she or it or whatever, then we're kind of missing the point, you know. This God is indefinable. I did bring this in just as a bit of a provocation as well. I wonder if you... this is a French philosopher called Antoine Comte-Sponville, and he wrote a book called The Book of Atheist Spirituality. I thought somebody gave this to me for Christmas, and as you can see, it's a well-marked book. And I would love to run a study with authentic atheists and authentic believers together, dialoguing together. Because if I read to you, and I will, in fact, to show you, perhaps, I've marked it with the yellow so that I could find it, because it is rather heavily marked. So André Comte-Sponde will actually share this experience with his atheist friends at a conference, and they got very nervous because they thought, oh my God, he's starting to believe in something, you know. So this is his account of his mystical experience. And I honestly believe that Nietzsche, knowing his Bible as well as he did, you know, he had a very good grip on the sort of God that he was believing in. As I said, it's a non sequitur. If the moment you say God, you surely, if such a thing is, then you can't kill that kind of God. You know, he either exists or he doesn't exist. And if he does exist, then, you know, it's ridiculous to suggest that we can kill him. Anyway, this is what he writes. The first time it happened, I was in a forest in the north of France. I must have been 25 or 26. I'd just been hired on to teach high school philosophy in a town on the edge of a canal up in the fields near the Belgian border. That particular evening, some friends and I had gone out for a walk in the forest we liked so much. Night had fallen. We were walking, just like we were walking tonight. Gradually, our laughter faded and the conversation died down. Nothing remained but our friendship, our mutual trust and shared presence, the mildness of the night air and of everything around us. My mind empty of thought, I was simply registering the world around me, the darkness of the undergrowth, the incredible luminosity of the sky, the faint sounds of the forest, branches snapping, an occasional animal call, our own muffled steps, only making the silence more palpable. And then all of a sudden, what? Nothing. Everything. No words, no meanings, no questions, only a surprise, only this, a seemingly infinite happiness, a seemingly eternal sense of peace. Above me, the starry sky was immense, luminous, and unfathomable, and within me, there was nothing but the sky of which I was a part, and the silence, and the light, like a warm hum, and a sense of joy with neither subject nor object, no object other than everything, no subject other than itself. Yes, in the darkness of that night, I contained only the dazzling presence of the all. Peace, infinite peace, simplicity, serenity, delight. Now, I used to read this to my students in religious and values education, and I would say, now, I wonder, what sort of a believing person do you think this was? And they'd all say, oh, obviously, they must be a Christian. And then when I tell them that it wasn't a Christian, that he actually was a Catholic, who on the strength of the experience of that night decided to become an atheist. And that's André Comte-Sponde. So I suppose the conclusion I would draw with them is, well, what's the difference? The difference is only in the label that you put on it. The experience is the same. And even Richard Dawkins, you know, when he talks about his conversion, you know, to atheism, and we know what an aggressive and silly atheist he is from time to time, much to the chagrin of his atheist friends, that he says that he was, what was it? He was in a frangipani tree or something, looking at the stars, and he suddenly had this revelation of becoming a scientist, and that his chaplain, of whom he speaks very fondly, found God while lying in the fields. You know, so you put those two together, and you think, well, what's the difference? Only the label put on it, but the experience is valid. The experience is real. And in the Chartist 77 movement in Czechoslovakia, when atheists and Christians and all these people got together on the one premise that they wanted truth and openness, there was no distinction between the believers and unbelievers. They were all people of integrity acting together. And I can truthfully say at Narrabundra, as Andrew and Dee would confirm, we have such a diversity of students. And I love walking in there and seeing the diversity of beliefs and you know, life styles that they live. Now, I'm conscious that, when are we supposed to be finishing, by the way? Quarter two? Yeah. Whatever we feel. So we don't want to keep it too late, but on the other hand, so are there any other questions that you would like to ask? But I thought that might kind of put that into a more, you know, tangible environment. I hope those... Sorry, I should be looking this way. On Zoom, it's always terrible when we look over there. All of you over there in Cyberland, you know, if you have questions, please ask them. People here are modestly waiting for you to ask a question, possibly. Yes, please. Richard. Just a little introduction to it, if I
could. Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm curious about Nietzsche putting these words into the mouth of a madman and what that says about his courage, because, as you said, the mad person will be escorted out
of the
church. And he must have realised that.
Most decidedly.
Yeah,
look, he's a provocateur. So, but he calls himself the Antichrist. I mean, come on. You know, I'm holding up a target. I'm the Antichrist. Who's going to throw stones at me? You know, it's an invitation, a provocation. What kind of Antichrist is the question? And that will be for the next lecture. What kind of Antichrist? And he argues, and I think one person who argues it very, very strongly is Key, I think it is. Keyes is his name. He argues that he's against that kind of Christ. So Christ and Nietzsche stand together against that kind of Christ. The kind of Christ that strips people of their, I don't know, their self-respect or makes them feel guilt-ridden. You know, the kind of tele-evangelist, you know, who plays on people's guilt and that in the name of Christ and destroys their sense of integrity. That's the kind of Christ he's against. The kind of Christ that leads people to kill Muslims. You know, the kind of Christ that justifies violent wars. The kind of God that justifies violent wars. That's the kind of God, Christ. And I can tell you, when I was at Radford as a chaplain, one of the highlights of my teaching was a girl who wrote this long letter. I deliberately destroyed it because it was too beautiful to keep. You know what I mean? It was too sacred and it would have been wrong. She said the chaplain, which they finally told to leave, stood over them and she said she couldn't see Jesus. All she could see was Jeebus! Jeebus! Shoving down this thing down her throat. Not seeing her for the kind of person that she was, you know, seeing through the lens of them and us, she said, I couldn't stand it. You know, Jeebus, that's the kind of Christ I think Nietzsche would be against. Please, Sarah. Oh dear, I'm feeling like my Oxford professor asked me a question. He said, what about the genealogy of morals? And he was a German, Johannes Zachhuber. What about the genealogy of morals?
Can you reassure you that the genealogy of morals was not?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank
you. So, the question kind of knocking around, which I can't quite formulate, but what's emerged out of, in the question time, is really that, and it emerges out of the parable of as Nietzsche, as a prophet, in like the prophets of old who were always against idolatry, against kind of false versions of...
Yes.
But you said something too about the way in which early on in the lecture you said something about how Nietzsche is wanting us to, in a sense, really face up to the unconsoledness of reality, or, you know, to get a deep sense of the abuse, the vastness, you know, to kind of break us out of the maybe cheap consolations or the too easy. So I guess my question is sort of in the terrain, is he just a prophet like all the other prophets, or is this something else going on? Because at one level it seems like if that's what he is, a prophet like all the other prophets, we should be able to recognise that, and it's controversial in the world of piety and all of that, but not as deeply there's a kind of, we know who that is at one level. So is there something else going on?
So what do you think? Well, what do you think is going on?
Well, I don't know. So that's the question that's knocking around. Mm. I don't know him, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of God is dead speech, as Trump said, there's a Meister Eckhart, you know, there's lots of people would say that God is dead.
Yes.
Is Nietzsche doing more than that?
That's a fascinating question, Sarah, and I think the way to answer that would be, I do think there's a prophetic element, no doubt in my mind, that he is speaking prophetically across many, you know, many areas. So that, for example, he's not just having a go at Christianity. You know, so when he talks about, you know, the three levels, you know, the saint, you know, the philosopher and the artist, and he puts the artist first. He's had to think through each one of those categories and define their strengths and their weaknesses. So you're right that he's doing more than just being a religious prophet. He's actually a prophet to all of humanity and all of its sciences. And, you know, he got to the point... Okay, let's start with The Birth of Tragedy. So at that point he was totally in love with, you know, Wagner and, you know, obviously, you know, the whole idea of the will, you know, and all of these things, you know, of the pessimism and so on, and the importance of art. And then he had to rethink the arts. He had to rethink the sciences. He had to rethink religion, all three. And then what we see in So Spoke Zarathustra is a kind of a, again, rather than coming out in the open and saying this is, he wants us to actually unpick it, so that if you fall into the error of seeing Zarathustra as saying precisely what Nietzsche thinks, then already you're on the wrong track, because Zarathustra is like a test case for his ideas, and even Zarathustra struggles and gets it wrong. And the idea there is that we can never, I mean, if we take the astrophysics, we only know 5% of what's out there. What is so humiliating about us saying, well, maybe we should defer judgment about anything? You know, if dark matter accounts for 95%, then all of us should be a bit more humble about our philosophy, about our religion, and about our art. You know, what is our art doing? So you're right, but on the getting back to your point, sorry, I realise I hadn't quite answered your question, Andrew, about the madman. But the madman is a fairly obvious. You know, you had Hamlet, you know, playing the fool, you know, and all of that was to catch people out, to draw people out. You know, and I think that's Nietzsche's role. And there is that prophetic element, no doubt. But also it goes much like, and that's why I think Christians are not entitled to feel wounded about just themselves. It's not just about them or about us as Christians. It's about all of us, without distinction. Whatever, wherever we sit on the side of belief or unbelief, Nietzsche, to me, creates exactly the kind of ground that André Comte-Sponville is looking for, a common ground. He's not decrying believing Christians or believing anybody. He's saying, why can't we just coexist together and, you know, mutually prize one another and value one another and, you know, cherish one another's gift that we bring to any discussion, I think is pretty amazing. Thank you, Sarah. I hope that sort of answered it, didn't it? Sorry? Oh, yes.
Francis again?
Francis.
Do I look that way?
Oh, sorry.
And unmute.
Unmute, please, Francis. Isn't that a dreadful thing?
I need to wonder aloud, I realise. I'm wondering if the fool too, not only the wise fool that we get in literature, but like the insane person being the only sane response to an insane society.
Yeah.
Do you
know
what I mean?
Like totally, yeah. And I think, doesn't that come out in some of the Auschwitz commentaries, you know, that you almost have to be insane to come to terms with what happened there, because everything is so, you know, lopsided and upside down and that you go insane, and it's the only solution to understand the insanity is to actually become insane. Of course, the irony is, as we know, that Nietzsche did become insane. And that was in Turin in Italy when he was watching somebody beating a horse, and he intervened, and somehow it pushed him into insanity. And
it is a sort of sanity,
exactly. And I was going to say that my Girardian friends used to love saying, "Oh, Nietzsche became mad at that point because he'd been holding back from being compassionate for so long that when he saw this, it suddenly imploded in him and he became mad." Well, they don't understand that he too was fought in the Franco-Prussian War, that he was probably a cavalry person as well as being a medic. And we all know how the cavalry, the rider and horse become very attached to each other. And when he saw this horse being beaten, it was a genuine compassion. Not a repressed compassion that expressed itself, a genuine compassion that flowed over and somehow triggered off because of the weakness in his family of mental health. I'm sorry, yes, please. Did you want to? I thought you were moving forward. Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been very, very kind hanging around for so long. So, Sarah, I will leave it to you to wind things up. Thank you so much.